Welcome back, everyone, to Gold Seek Radio. It's a pleasure to be with you this weekend. We have another infotainment-packed show and two more big industry insiders with their thoughts on the markets. I'm your host, Chris Waltzek. According to Zero Hedge, the Buffett Indicator is making a solid case for 20% gold returns for the next decade. That's right. Those are Warren Buffett-sized returns. So just what is the Oracle of Omaha calling his favorite valuation metric? It's the ratio of total stock market cap to GDP, and it's historically proven to be useful and a reliable indicator of long-term returns in equities and the precious metals. It hasn't been this overextended since, wait for it, Q3 2000. Some of my middle-aged folks like myself, that rings some bells. That was the peak of the internet stock bubble. Most of these money managers today, they've only read about the internet stock bubble in textbooks. If we can use this indicator as a guide, we could be looking at 10 years of 15 to 20% returns in the yellow metal, and even better for related share prices. Keep in mind, the Oracle is so convinced that this could be a top that he's put his $80 billion in his little piggy bank into cash. In fact, he's sold off virtually all, if not 100%, of his shares at Berkshire Hathaway. So my first guest today agrees with the Oracle. He's also gone into cash and sold all his shares. Boston University economist Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, widely respected, returns with a new free book, You're Hired. With over $220 trillion in national debt, when we include the entitlement programs, even if we were to put aside 10% of the GDP each year to paying off the debt, it would still require an infinite number of years for us to get caught up on our debts. It just can't be done. We need to be making contingency plans now. And then an old friend returns to the show, Dr. Paul Wilmot, a founder of the field of quantitative finance, widely respected worldwide, and for some reason, they won't give this doctor a professorship. Well, he's penned yet another magnum opus, and it was endorsed by legendary Nassim Taleb, and he's a doctor now too, and that's about as good as it gets. We discuss all kinds of interesting topics, including the millennial prizes, P versus NP, the Navier-Stokes equations, as well as algorithmic trading, the implications and my findings from the experimental side, and his as a theorist. And remember to sign up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter. We continue to outperform the markets and still have an impressive 20% plus yielding portfolio for folks who would like oversized gains and aren't looking for oversized capital gains. They just want their money to provide them income while staying relatively stable. This might be the portfolio for you. So we'd like for you to log on and sign up at gsrhughes.net or just sign up on the webpage through PayPal or credit card. And we'd like your questions and comments on the hotline. That's 641-715-3900, followed by the extension 514049. And Robert Ian returns with another must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility virtually unlimited over the precious metals sector as gold posted its best gain since the middle of last month amid U.S. dollar pressure, which slid sharply under support, and a pullback in U.S. equities. Gold picked up $25, 2%, ending at $12.52 an ounce, while silver picked up 40 cents, closing at $16.80 an ounce. The precious metals XAU shares added 20 cents, closing at 85, while black gold blasted higher 6%, way back up above support, ending higher by almost $3 at $50.67 a barrel. And we think it could be setting up now finally for that run to 75 and on to 100. Precious metals volatility increased with political unrest at the White House this week. News that the administration let go FBI Director James Comey led to reprisals regarding ties between the administration and Russia. The news increased demand for safe haven as investors felt less confident over the impending tax cuts and deregulation. In related news on Friday, in a speech at the Olin Business School in Missouri, St. Louis Fed President James Bullard questioned the need for June rate increases. But nevertheless, he's not a voting member, and the current Fed Funds futures contract contracts indicate very high odds of a rate hike at the next FOMC meeting, slated for next month. Investors appear to have factored in at least 1 to 2 more rate hikes this year. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, over the past 2 weeks, the precious metals and commodities sectors have made impressive rebound rallies. From a technical vantage, gold seems to be carving out an impressive bullish inverted head and shoulders pattern. That's quite a mouthful. It should be complete in about a month or so. That would provide the gunpowder necessary to launch an assault on the 1,500 per ounce resistance point. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, clouds rolled in over the New York Stock Exchange this week on whether or not the current administration can push through corporate tax plans. By Friday's close, on the Dow Jones Industrials declined only 92 points, finishing at 2804. The S&P 500 gave back 9, finishing at 2382, while the Nasdaq dropped about 37, still at 6,083. Hard to believe. Lastly, the Bitcoin ETF shot up sharply, nearly 20%, and the Komodo ICO is up over 44 cents. That's up more than 100-fold just in the past few months. However, I will note that things are starting to look a bit toppy in the coming weeks for the cryptocurrencies. Moving on, investors are concerned by lower earnings forecasts, which are considered the lifeblood of the stock market. Higher earnings increase profit margins, which of course improves spending and hiring, and then that tends to lead to an upward spiral as corporations pick up more folks, consumer spending increases, and consumer confidence improves. These are all key components of the GDP. New applications for jobless benefits fell last week, and the number of Americans on the unemployment rolls fell to nearly a 30-year low, pointing to a surprisingly strong, solid labor market. Bottom line on equities. Well, all this negative talk on the markets really had a small impact. One would have expected, given the political turmoil this week domestically, to see, 500,000, 1,500 point down days on the Dow, and it was just a drop in the bucket. I really don't see any major technical damage. In fact, I think the surprising resiliency of these markets and the number of naysayers who just came out of the woodwork this week, again, way too many bears in the crowd to start talking about a top just yet. So time will tell. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek. Well, we're so glad you've chosen GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing information source. Today's special guest, Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff from Boston University and author of The Inform Act. My featured guest today says economic calamity is inevitable. It's just a matter of when the entire edifice implodes. Author of The Clash of the Generations, Get What's Yours, The Secrets to Maximizing Social Security, Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff of Boston University joins us. He's also the author of The Inform Act, which we've talked about here on the show. Welcome back, Professor Kotlikoff.
Great to be back with you.
You know, Professor, you've brought up this in the past. I think it's really worth repeating here that the United States may be in worse financial shape than even Detroit, which, of course, went bankrupt.
Okay, well, what we've done is Enron-type accounting at the federal level for decades. Well, we've kept our obligations, most of our obligations, IOUs that Uncle Sam has issued, off the books. So, to make this clear, if I go to Uncle Sam comes to you today and takes $10,000 in taxes, in money, takes $10,000 from you and then promises to pay you back $50,000 in 30 years, and if he calls what he takes from that $10,000 that he takes from you taxes, and he calls the $50,000 in the future a transfer payment, then that obligation to pay you the $50,000 doesn't show up on the books. And on the other hand, if he takes the $10,000 and calls that $10,000 he takes from you borrowing and says that the $50,000 or some portion of it is return of principal plus interest, then whatever he says he owes you in the future on that borrowing is going to be included in the book, on the books. It will be entered as part of official debt. So we're keeping almost all our liabilities off the books. About 80% of our liabilities are off the books. Our official debt's about $20 trillion. Our true debt is about $200 trillion. That's what we call the fiscal gap, which is the difference in present value between all the projected future spending and all the projected future taxes. So the net present value fiscal gap is about $200 trillion large. That's 10 times larger than the official debt.
Estimates of long-term debt range wildly, and you've put numbers out there in excess of $200 trillion. I mean, this is a startling number. I'm sure it's far exceeds the global GDP. Very few people can wrap their minds around to think in terms of millions, let alone trillions. What are the implications of $200 trillion?
Okay, we're talking about 10% of GDP, about a tenth of our output every year. We would have to set aside to pay off this fiscal gap every year. So if we took 10% of GDP for the rest of time, the present value of that would come up to about $200 trillion. So another way of putting this is that we either need to raise taxes by about 53%, every single federal tax, and that would produce about 10% of GDP in revenue, or we could cut every single government expenditure, defense, my mom's Social Security checks, all the payments for Medicare, cut all that stuff by about 33%, and we'd also come up with a save 10% of GDP every year, and that also would balance the book. So you can see that this is a tremendously difficult thing to deal with, because we're so far into the red. Now, we knew that the baby boomers were going to retire. We knew for decades that things were going to hit the fan when that happened. And every year we just got closer and closer to having to make these transfer payments, which were not put on the books. So we ignored them. And so this is the malfeasance that both parties have engaged in for decades. Interestingly, there is one person at the White House who seems to understand the magnitude of our indebtedness, and that's Steve Bannon. Not that I'm a fan of Steve Bannon's association with Breitbart and some of his unusual opinions about things. He does. He has mentioned this fiscal gap in public over the years. So that's, I find that kind of curious. But in the main, the Republicans and the Democrats don't want to hear about this because they don't want to reveal the kind of hot water they put our children in. It's highly unethical. Both President Washington and President Jefferson admonished the country not to leave our debts on, you know, for our children to pay. And we've done it through this kind of, you know, pay, take as you go, take money, call it taxes from young people, give it to ourselves, older people, we spend it, and then we promise our kids that when they're old, they'll get repaid in the form of transfer payments, and then they become old and they have to look to their kids to rip off their kids. It's not what you do when you're an adult running a country, but that's exactly what this 6 decades of political machinations have produced. So, yeah, it's a terrible situation. We have in the Inform Act, if you go to theinformact.org, theinformact.org, there's a bill that I helped write that was endorsed by seven senators, I think eight senators, one of whom is Tim Kaine, the Democratic vice presidential nominee, and Senator Thorne. Those are the two co-sponsors. Thorne is a Republican from, I believe, North or South Dakota, one of the Dakotas. Tim is a senator from, from Virginia, Tim Kaine. So we have some responsible people in the Senate, but they couldn't come up with enough votes to get this thing passed, and it's just waiting there to be passed at some point in the future. And the requirement of the bill is that the CBO and the GAO and the OMB, these are the three big government agencies that calculate the deficit and the debt, that they actually start doing meaningful deficit accounting, which is fiscal gap analysis. And our fiscal gap is going up by the tune of about $6 trillion a year, so that's our true deficit. The official deficit is much smaller because, again, we're keeping so much off the books. I know you folks are focused on gold and whether it makes sense to hold gold. The reality is that there is a good reason to do that, to make sure you're safe, because the country's going broke. And I don't see any politician who's coming forward to really explain the magnitude of our indebtedness.
You actually triggered a memory. If I recall correctly, you penned a tome back in 2005. the coming, I want to say, generational storm. If memory serves, I mean, you really tied in here an important key concept. And we've been warning, obviously, now for over a decade, this government profligacy, it ends poorly. And we will not have the demographic base to sustain this growing, you might say, discrepancy between retirees, because the retiree base is living longer and longer. You brought up in the past your mom, who evidently, I think, is approaching 98. Or maybe 98 by now after reading the article. She's in solid health. And that's, of course, a wonderful gift. Nevertheless, you know, the younger generations are being forced by our policymakers to pay for this. And you just don't think that's sustainable. Please tell us more.
We have to do a policy reform that is either that's the equivalent of either raising taxes by 53% immediately and permanently. Every single federal tax rate has to go up by that amount, or cut spending by 33%, or some combination of tax hikes and spending cuts to eliminate the fiscal gap. So the longer we wait to deal with this problem, the bigger the burden that will be left for our kids. If we wait for 20 years to address this problem, then the tax hike won't be 53%, be more like 65%. At some point, our kids will, you know, if we start rate, we're going to have to print, you know, the politicians will likely try and resort to printing money. That's likely to lead to very high inflation. They're likely to try and nickel and dime us as they've been doing in different ways in a very complex tax code to make us unaware of the fact that we're paying so much in taxes. But it still won't be enough because the problem is so big. We've seen this movie in Argentina, in other countries. You know, Russia has at times run hyperinflation where they couldn't pay their bills. They've had to default on their official debt. At some point, things go very badly, and we could see our kids leave the country because they can't make a living here, or they can make a living, but then the taxes are so high that they've got nothing left to live on. Uruguay, there was a mass exodus of almost 500,000 people from that small country because the tax rates were so high because the country was so indebted. So we have to put everything on the books. We have to be honest with ourselves and with our children where we stand. We have to adopt policies that are actually going to eliminate the fiscal gap. And the easiest way to do this is to eliminate the growth of spending, especially in the healthcare area, where the CBO is projecting significant ongoing increases in Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare expenditures. So I have a book on my website, which is kotlikoff.net, which it's called You're Hired! So You're Hired! A Trump Playbook for Fixing America's Economy. So I wrote this 100-page book after the election, hoping that somebody in the Trump administration would actually pick it up and follow it and take the plans there to fix healthcare, to fix Social Security, to fix the tax system, to fix the banking system, to fix the education system. But so far I've heard from nobody in the Trump administration that they've even looked at it. I'm not seeing policies that are actually going to address this fiscal gap. It looks like the tax, you know, at best the tax reform will be revenue neutral, and the healthcare reform will likely not get passed, which means that we won't really get everybody covered under some sensible basic healthcare plan and get a lid on federal spending. What we're getting is, under the current status quo, is more and more spending by the federal government in total, and it's directed towards a small segment of society, a relatively small segment. That's not working for the whole population, or certainly not working for our kids. I've been working on this issue since grad school, I graduated in 1977, 40 years ago. So it's been four decades that I've been studying our fiscal imbalance, and every year it's gotten worse.
I don't know if this really ties in perfectly or not, but read an article this morning noting that the world's wealthiest individual, Warren Buffett, recently announced that he has liquidated 100% of his U.S. equities positions, that he's entirely in cash, $80 billion in his piggy bank. He seems to share your sentiments that perhaps the markets have gotten away from themselves and that there just isn't the rosy economic outlook. It's just maybe not sustainable. You've also talked about how long-term treasuries could suffer substantially against this backdrop of government printing. Eventually, that's just a terrible scenario for our banks, which are carrying, you know, the major money lending banks, money center banks, have over $250 trillion in derivatives. Any comments there?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think Warren Buffett's right. I took all my money out of the stock market in February, and I wrote publicly. I read a syndicated column that shows up in like the Dallas Morning News and the Austin Statesman and the Seattle Times and some other papers around the country once a week. And I wrote in my very first column back in February, I said, get out of the market because the price earnings ratio are pretty much at an all time high, not an all time high, but a very high historic level. And, there's nothing in the Trump plan in what he's proposing that would justify, a big run-up in the stock market post-election, which we've seen. There's this underlying fiscal sort of Damocles that's hanging over our economy, which nobody seems to recognize. Yeah, I think Warren is exactly right that the traders down on Wall Street are just trading on what other people are that is inducing them to, well, I think everybody else is buying, so I'll buy. That's just a prescription for a major crash in the market. And that's really what I foresee. So that's why I told everybody in my column to get out, and I took a lot of flack for that. And the market's basically been kind of flat since I said that. It's been down, now it's back up a bit. Position, I don't see the basis for it to be where it is. And yeah, printing money will lead to long-term bonds dropping in value, and that's going to, if the banks are holding long-term bonds as part of their portfolio of assets, they'll suffer major capital losses. Insolvent again, we can have a repeat of the 2008 banking crisis. The assets that the banks held became kind of hot potatoes. Nobody wanted to buy them, and they dropped in value. And then when they do that, they get marked to market. Now the banks are, you know, kind of technically insolvent. They don't have enough capital to cover their liabilities. So, or enough assets to cover their liabilities, and that's why you had so much government nationalization of and intervention in the banking system.
The St. Louis Fed's Fred website, you're right, the balance sheet stagnant there at last check around $4 to $5 trillion, although there's been a lot of rhetoric from policymakers that we might see, at least the FOMC meeting minutes, that we could see pullback in that Fed sheet. There just doesn't seem to be any evidence of it. They don't seem to have the wiggle room to reduce toxic debt from the balance sheet.
Yeah, I mean, if they start selling these assets back into the market, these bonds of different types, that's going to drop bond prices and raise interest rates. And that's going to do exactly what I just said, which is if banks are holding bonds, if bond prices in general are falling, then those bonds that the banks hold as assets on that side of their balance sheet will go down in value. And then their assets will be small relative to their liabilities, and their equity makes up the difference. It's the thing that gives. And if that equity goes to zero or below zero, it becomes a situation of bankruptcy. So, yeah, we don't have a financial system that's any different fundamentally, despite Dodd-Frank, than we had before the 2008 crisis. We haven't dealt with the two major problems in banking, which are leverage and lack of transparency. There's somewhat less leverage. There's no extra additional transparency, and the stress test that experiments that are being run, I think, are basically a sham, because in the context of a major financial panic, assets are going to drop in value beyond what the stress test shows. And if you looked at Lehman Brothers about 3 days before they declared bankruptcy, they were reporting a pretty high capital ratio, and the SEC must have approved their statement that they had a pretty high capital ratio, something like 11%. Well, I don't think any bank in the country today any major bank has that much capital. So if Lehman Brothers was actually telling the truth, then what happened was that nobody either believed Lehman Brothers, believed their books, or believed anybody else would believe them and was going to actually invest with them. So they all pulled, went and engaged in a run on Lehman Brothers. They either didn't hand Lehman Brothers any money, didn't lend them any money, or they just asked for their money back. And then Lehman Brothers ran short of cash and had to declare bankruptcy. It's kind of knife edge. If you mix a dollar of payments to somebody, a depositor or a brokerage account where you owe money and somebody wants the money back, you're out of business. And that's exactly what happened. So we need to fix banking from the ground up. And that's not happening in this Trump administration. They want to have Dodd-Frank away and go back to business as usual. House Financial Services Committee, if you go and look at the membership of the House Financial Services Committee, the chairman, the ranking members of that committee, and then you look at the donors, you'll find J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, other Citigroup, Bank of America. The major financial companies are bribing the people running, the members of Congress on the House Financial Services Committee, and they're now bribing them to through campaign contributions, and they're bribing them to get rid of Dodd-Frank, and that's what is on President Trump's agenda. I'm not a fan of Dodd-Frank. I think it's a lousy piece of legislation. I'd like to see it repealed, but what they have in mind doing is not pushing us towards more opacity, more disclosure, and more equity in the system, but towards the good old days where the entire system could, you know, where there's very little federal oversight and the entire system can go down more or less overnight. There's plenty of room to be concerned. Fortunately, the economy seems to be doing pretty well right now, and that's hopeful. But and I hope I'm just dead wrong on everything that I see. I've certainly been predicting major problems from this fiscal gap for a long time, and we haven't seen anything yet happen. So I have some egg on my face from what I've been saying, but when you have 19 Nobel Prize winners endorse the Inform Act, and you have thousands of top economists from around the country endorse the Inform Act, and you have George Shultz, the former Secretary of Treasury and State, endorse the Inform Act, and major former heads of the Council of Economic Advisors endorse the Inform Act, and the list goes on, OMB directors endorsing the Inform Act, then what you've got is the entire economic community of grown-ups saying, this is how we should do the analysis. And when you do the analysis that way, you find we're in very deep debt. I'm not the only one who believes this. I think I'm now got the entire economics profession with me in this concern because they've all signed up. Just go to theinformact.org. You'll see 19 Nobel Prize winners have endorsed a bill. That's something unheard of. We've never seen 19 economists who won the Nobel Prize endorse any piece of legislation. It's very, very, very rare for this to happen. It's basically unheard of. That tells you a lot that we economists see collectively a big problem with the U.S. Government's finances.
Well, Professor, I think your efforts are laudable, and certainly there's no need to apologize by simply being way ahead of the curve. It reminds me of Frank Partnoy's, you might remember his groundbreaking novel there, Fiasco. I mean, he outlined the 2008 crisis a decade almost before working up at Morgan Stanley on Wall Street, and he was selling these financial weapons of mass destruction, and he just said, I can't be part of this anymore, went on, earned his law degree, and I believe now still teaches law out on the West Coast, and I think that's what you've done here so well. Hat tip for that. Any parting comments for our listeners? I'm sure you have some key takeaway points.
I write a lot about these kind of macro issues, but also about micro issues, how households can help themselves financially. I write a syndicated column, and as I mentioned, so if you go to kotlikoff.net, you can see all the columns that I've been writing about tax reform, about healthcare reform, about how to think about longevity risk. You know, some things are more macro, some are more personal. Should you take your retirement account money before you take your Social Security or not? The other way around, how to maximize Social Security benefits, And then you also see links to my company's really powerful personal financial planning software. We just came out with a couple new programs. One is called Analyze My Divorce Settlement. We've got 4,500 people a day, every day, 4,500 people are getting divorced, and they're doing so without really a clear understanding of how they're being treated in the settlement. So this software, which only costs $99, can help you figure out, are you getting a fair deal? What's your living standard going to be like compared to your spouse's living standard once you're divorced? And so it can help you come up with a fair settlement, either on your own or with your spouse. You can propose something that you feel is fair and know for sure how you're being treated, and avoid all these bills to the lawyers and all the huge wars that occur around divorce. Another program we have is called MaxifiPlanner.com. So it's MaxifiPlanner. And this is a program that figures out a basic plan for your future in terms of saving and spending and buying life insurance. But then it figures out how to maximize your plan and get you more lifetime spending power by figuring out what you should do on Social Security, by figuring out how you should deal with your retirement accounts, by figuring out whether or not you should annuitize your retirement accounts when you start taking the money. So it's really powerful. Both of these new tools are online. Both cost $99 for the household and about $3.99 for financial planners to use with households.
Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, we appreciate your thoughts and look forward to talking to you again.
My pleasure, and thanks again for having me.
Dr. Wilmot, it's just a pleasure to have him back here on the show. It's been several years, much too long, described by the Financial Times as a cult derivatives lecturer, an expert in quantitative finance and derivatives. Welcome back.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be back.
Why don't we start off today with The Money Formula? This is your latest tome, co-authored with David Orrell.
Well, it's meant for a more popular audience than my other books, which are really mathematical. The reader who has an interest in science, maybe once upon a time did a bit of mathematics, but not necessarily, but wants to know about what's going on within high finance in terms of the scientific and mathematical base for how people trade or design new financial instruments. Because over the last few decades, the entire finance industry seems to be moving increasingly towards using the ideas of mathematics and statistics. And you can't do anything really in finance these days without having a PhD. Not always, but often you need a PhD in some scientific or mathematical discipline. So that's what the book is about, in a nutshell. But it's not just a history book. It also explains about the dangers within finance and risk management.
This is a fascinating topic. It's actually near and dear to me as well. It was the subject of my humble PhD dissertation. The way in which financial engineers have a tendency to delude oneself with this almost above human-like ability to comprehend the markets. And when you really take a look at the data and you crunch the numbers, I think what we find is, and you've done just an eloquent job of outlining this in your recent, not just recent, but in all of your work, it's not so simple. In fact, these markets are highly complex. And just at the moment that one thinks the equation has encapsulated all of the variables, there's that black swan moment that comes out of left field. Tell us more.
One gets the impression that financial engineers, particularly, I wish I were in physics, I wish I were doing quantum something or other. What they seem to try to do is to come up with theorems and laws and whatnot that try to describe how the financial markets and economies work in a physics-like way. Now, of course, human beings don't necessarily obey, they don't obey any laws, literally. And figuratively. And so these models that economists and quants create are sort of appealing because they feel a bit like physics. And They may be elegant like physics, but and maybe they make the economists feel, you know, somehow equal to clever physicists, Nobel Prize winning physicists. But the reality is, the models don't do what they're told, and you may get a false, totally false sense of security by using these physics-like models. Now, this is completely crazy to me because I come from a fluid mechanics background, and fluid mechanics, when you're doing fluid mechanics research, you're basically given the equations. The equations you work with are the Navier-Stokes equations.
Navier-Stokes, that's a favorite. You really use triple integrate.
Those equations, you can't really argue with them because they're based upon conservation of mass and conservation of momentum, and basically Newton. So you can't, it's not like you can say, well, I don't think fluids behave like that. I'm going to come up with a different model because fluids do behave like that. End of story. Whereas in finance and economics, you've got so much more scope for doing creative things. So really, it ought to be the other way around. It should be the physicists and the applied mathematicians should be jealous of economists and jealous of finance and engineers because in finance and economics, we've got so much potential for doing creative things, which actually you don't necessarily have in physics. You're looking for the laws, but you don't have that much flexibility, really, in where you can look. So it's almost the wrong way around. I wish economists and financial engineers would just have a little bit more confidence in their own fields and not trying to make it like physics.
You've covered a lot of bases there, and it, again, has just happened to be something I'm fascinated by. I actually did a little bit of humble work here on the Navier-Stokes, and where we use triple integration to attempt to model it, and I'm sure you're familiar, there's a rather hefty prize being offered for folks who can crack open by Clay Institute up in New England, $1 million prize.
Clay, as you say, the Clay Institute has prizes for several different...
Yeah, the Millennial Prizes.
Yes, they have several, and they have a list of which are the open prizes. Most of them are highly pure abstract mathematics. As far as I recall, it's only the Navier-Stokes equation, which is the only open question really in applied mathematics.
P versus NP, that's a bit more of a computational problem. That, of course, the traveling salesman, P versus NP, is one of the Millennial Prizes still open. But I think you're right. It wouldn't really qualify as pure mathematics. So what I did want to touch on, because you did bring this up, and I think it's really pertinent to the discussion today, this concept of physics and mathematics being more of a concrete field, where Einstein's field equations, when you delve into them, you see that gravity behaves exactly as expected. Of course, until we get to the quantum level, right? But this is, the takeaway I'd like for our audience to have today, that economics and finance are far less predictable. In my little body of work, I try to point out that there are contingency plans that can be put in place to help one navigate through such a complex investing environment. Would you like to comment on that, or is that outside your purview?
That's fine. I think that's the place where the scope for creativity lies. You can say you're an economist, you can say, well, I'm going to assume everybody behaves the same, or I'm going to assume everybody behaves rationally, and then come up with some theorem or laws. Or you could say, well, I'm going to work with the fact that people do behave irrationally. I'm going to work with statistics. Or you could say, well, I know there's a certain part of of the world where people do behave rationally. Then there's a part where people toss coins. And then, you know, there's a part of humanity which they would just do the wrong thing just for the, and trying to understand all of that means having to understand human nature and bring together human nature and maths and finance and economics. I think that is makes it such a wonderful field. But economists are actually trying to iron out all of the wonderful human bits. And I think they're missing a great opportunity there.
I think you've bifurcated the discussion here into A, perhaps economists are missing the point. These markets are just a wee bit beyond our current ability to model them. B, this remarkable opportunity for creativity. I mean, and I think you've done such a good job, obviously, in your work, outlining the opportunities within the derivatives field, options and futures, and let's say diversifying away risk from many aspects of business and investing. Please tell us more.
I think economists have a problem that they heard. It's very difficult if you're in you're an academic and you want to do something different from your peers, you get very, very rapidly get disowned. And so it's very difficult for economists, if they want to keep their job, to not. That's one problem. But I think we do have lots of tools. And in the book that David and I have written, there's one part where we actually talk about fields that was fashionable just before quantitative finance became fashionable. Now, quantitative finance became big. Well, it was big in the States, in business schools. It took a while before it hit the UK and also before it became big in math departments. Before it was big in math departments, one of the hot topics was mathematical biology. Great, great field. My brother actually did his doctorate in mathematical biology, but it's something where, again, you're trying to model some things that aren't certainly rational. You can't talk about, if you try to model, for example, populations of lions and gazelles. Now, lions eat gazelles. The more gazelles there are, the more there are for lions to eat, and lion population grows, etc. But as it grows, well, then they start to eat more gazelles, and the gazelle population dies off, but then, as a consequence of lion population, you can see the sort of interesting dynamics you have there. And of course, mathematical biology encompasses diseases as well, or diverse topics. And there it's not unlike how finance or economics should be, in that you're never really expecting to predict exactly the lion population. It's more like you've got a toy model which is explained more qualitatively. And so finance and economics could use a lot of the tools that people in mathematical biology have been using. They have to understand that their models are never going to be perfect. They're toy models that may inspire you to how to control interest rates to have some effect, rather than, you know, some central bank will say, come up with a prediction for growth in next year. A month later, they change the prediction. But it's worse than weather forecasting. Why did they bother making a forecast in the first place? They never put error bounds on, at least in weather forecasting. Certainly, not so much in the UK, but in the other side of the Atlantic, you always hear the chance of rainfall is, in the UK, it will rain tomorrow. It didn't. You should have put a percentage to it. That's your get-out clause. So you can do exactly the same with finance and economics, toy models. Expect them to work approximately, but never to be precise.
We tend to have these linear models. As an undergraduate, I took quantitative, as you said, and it's ironic, in the business school, quantitative finance in the business school. It was not offered in our mathematics department. The models that we had at that time, although it has morphed a bit lately, were primarily linear, and linear just does not model human behavior or gazelles and lions, as you put it. So that's certainly a constraint that we have.
That is one of my favorite topics, was the non-linearity. Yeah, the world is non-linear. Everything is non-linear. Business is non-linear. When you buy one beer, it costs you a certain amount of money. If you buy a crate of beer, it costs you, you know, per bottle, it costs you less. There's all sorts of things that one experiences just from going down to the supermarket that is not in this quadrillion-dollar business. You think that it's going to be a quadrillion, one followed by 15 zeros, dollars worth of complex derivatives out there, they'd at least be, you know, more statistically. But everything is assumed to be linear, which means that, hey, if we're making $1 from selling one of these contracts, if we sell 10 of them, we make $10. If we sell a million, hey, what if we sell a billion? What if we sell a trillion? Changing the world economy, and you haven't realized that actually selling a trillion of something might not be a good idea.
It sounds ominous. It looks as though you feel the system might be doomed to its own by its own success.
Well, the problem is that it is. There are all sorts of issues. All sorts of issues. I mean, we could talk about regulators. We could talk about moral hazards. We could talk about all sorts of different issues. But everything is pointing in the same direction, which is people, bankers, are trying to get as much money out of the system on whatever is the latest bandwagon, as quickly as they can before either regulators step in or something blows up. And that's kind of the game. And a lot of the time, mathematics can be used to help them in this game. If someone comes up with a model which says, hey, there's no risk, they love that. They love that, because if the model says there's no risk, they can trade more and more and more and more and more. Of course, the model has got risk. It is that they are managing to fool people that their model says there's no risk.
I think you've also pointed out that sometimes people make irrational decisions. My background in economics, we spend so much time trying to discuss utility and this idea of rational thinking, but there are times when the herd does not behave as expected. The linearity, as you say, goes right out the window.
Well, I mentioned bandwagons, probably computer trading, algorithm trading, high-frequency trading, and the human trading decisions. And I don't see that as a very good thing at all. Trading is happening on the short and shorter time scale. The link between the price you see in the market and the value of some share starting to will disappear. And it just feels like another one of those bandwagons that's not going to end well. But from a banker's perspective, any bandwagon is good. They just have to, as much money as possible while the bandwagon still has its wheels.
You know, this is interesting as well, because I spent several years with automated trading using MetaTrader, and we could deploy as many as 20, you might call them robots, but they're just programs. We called them robots, robotic systems on different currency pairs from, let's say, the euro dollar, arbitrage at very fast speeds. All you really had to do is make sure the system was working properly and it didn't blow up. And I can see where your concerns are there, because it, on the positive side, it removes the human emotion from the scenario. There's zero oversight there. And I think that's what you're really leading up to here. You're concerned that we have this sort of aha wake-up moment where the machines are running the show. What does that lead to?
It ceases to become relevant what the value. You have to distinguish the value of something and the price of something. The value, something that the price is meant to kind of cover or bounce around. Because in the market, so you just price it, you don't really know what the value is. But the value of a share of a company does matter to the people who work there. You know, if the value of a company collapses, that's going to have some impact on the people who work there. If the computers are doing all the trading, the value, all they care about is, oh, I can buy it for this and I can sell it a second later for a little bit more. It becomes irrelevant what the value of the company is, and ultimately the value of the employees, what their value is. If all it is just computers playing games with each other.
Brings up an interesting point, and maybe you would have some comments here. If, for instance, we were talking about earlier the difficulty of modeling complex systems such as human behavior, or let's say human responses to economic activity, corporate earnings reports, things of this nature, let's say economic shocks, externalities. If that is difficult to model, what happens when 70% of the volume of the New York Stock Exchange is robotically controlled? Does that put some constraints on the system and make it more easy to model? And what would be the ramifications?
Well, that reminds me of a story going back a couple of decades now. But I was browsing through a university library, and I don't know what I was originally looking for, but I came across a book. It was called something like the UK Treasury's Model of the British Economy, something like that. And it was about an inch or so thick, this book. And it had, my memory is it had 770 equations, 770 different equations that were supposed to represent the economy. All pretty linear, or maybe there was occasional logarithm or exponential, but nothing too complicated. 770 equations. As an applied mathematician, I know that anything like that is going to have, if it is non-linear, it's almost certainly going to have chaos coming out of the other end. It's going to be useless for prediction. You're never going to know what the parameters in this thing are. But really, what you ought to do is say, take the 770 equation and whittle it down to the key half a dozen. Get six equations out of this that are robust, which give you ballpark where, interest rates or whatever is going. But I know that the economists who were looking at this thing were thinking, the reason why we don't get the answers right, why we can't solve it, is because we need 771 equations.
You've hit the nail on the head. I can share a very brief story here as well. Having worked through well over 1,200 different trading robots for the markets, what one finds very quickly is robustness is the key, because there's so much cherry picking, as what traders would call it. You find out very quickly, without that robust character, I think I found two that actually held up out of those 1,200, and we still use the same models today. today. I did my best in my dissertation to point out, look, there are some very simplistic ways to increase the robustness of your models and would keep this whole house of cards from imploding. And would you care to discuss your interesting formula that you've brought up in the past with the modulus and absolute values that keeps one from falling into the trap of linearity?
When I first started working in quant finance in the late 80s, we were doing lots of things with Black Scholes, and then somebody suggested, talking about transaction costs. When you have a derivative, the key to valuation, and this is the Nobel Prize winning Black Scholes Mervyn idea, the key to valuation is that you buy your option, and then you still in place, you sell some of the stock, and you do this on a continual basis, for sort of dynamic hedging. By doing that, you can eliminate risk. You don't care until the stock goes up or down, because if the option goes up, well, the stock goes down, and I'm balanced. I'm risk-free. So, but the problem with this, buying and selling stock for hedging purposes costs money. It's a bit off the spread. Elizabeth Worley and I did lots of work on transaction costs, and it turns out it's a non-linear equation. It's like the Black-Scholes equation, but it has a non-linear term, as you mentioned. One of the first times has been a non-linear equation in quantitative finance. And then thereafter, there's been other people doing work ending up with non-linear equations, and as we mentioned earlier, non-linearity just captures something about the real world, but the popular models don't. But we have here a problem. They're harder to solve. You have to actually do some number crunching. You have to do some serious coding. It's not just a case of putting it into a calculator, like with the famous Black-Scholes thing. People are reluctant to do that. They're reluctant to do hardcore programming to try out different models, particularly nonlinear models. And it's one of my particular complaints I have is that, especially in interest rates, people tend to choose their models that they use for valuation because they are simple, because they got a nice formula. So rather than having to write a lot of complicated code, they have a formula. So they choose the interest rate model that is simplest. Not necessarily the most accurate, the simplest. Now, considering how many trillions of dollars go to interest rate products, it seems a bit strange relying on a formula that you choose because of its simplicity rather than its accuracy. It would be like, and the analogy I often use is going back to Navier-Stokes, so suppose you were designing an airplane and you had to deal with the Navier-Stokes equation. Well, the Navier-Stokes equation is non-linear. Oh, I don't like non-linear equations. Let's cross off this term from the equation, because if I cross this off, it's so much easier. And then you design the plane, and of course the plane crashes. Couldn't get away with this in every other field except finance. Only in finance can you choose a model so that it's easy to use rather than it's accurate.
Yes, and only in finance could one win the Nobel Prize and then blow up long-term capital management a few years later. Other folks in the field who have comments on Dr. Wilmot's money formula here. This book has humor, attitude, clarity, science, common sense, pulls no punches, takes no prisoners. That's Dr. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, one of our favorites here. High praise indeed from a father of modern quantitative analysis here.
Because they're getting nothing to write
It was costly. I was going to say he's not one to shell out compliments. I was wondering just how many dinners or lunches or coffees that required. Anything you'd like to add about the money formula before we wrap up?
Other than buy it and give us a great reviews on Amazon? I think covered that quite well. Thank you very much.
Well, we appreciate you making time for us today. We know that you have a very busy schedule and look forward to your next must-read tome, which I'm sure we'll be able to find as well on Amazon.com.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Former FBI Director Robert Mueller III was appointed as the special counsel to oversee the investigation of whether Russia interfered with the 2016 U.S. presidential election. This has far-reaching implications that seem to have most in Congress, regardless of political ideology, and most in the media, whether liberal or conservative, getting more frantic in their analysis of exactly what this means. What this means is that just about everyone has lost control of the narrative and the political spin on this issue. Not that that will quiet the rhetoric and speculation. It's that without access to information that will now be tied up within the purview of the special counsel, any leaks or unmaskings that do occur, with a special counsel working in the background, will take on extraordinary risk for those doing the leaking and unmasking. The frenzy in the media right now is how this is or is not going to impact President Trump, his team, and associates. But it actually goes much further than that. You see, this investigation is about interference into the 2016 U.S. presidential election. And there were many more participants in that election than just President Trump. Former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton were involved in the 2016 election. Former Senator and presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and her team were involved in the 2016 election. That's three presidents and one presidential candidate. That is why this investigation is such a big deal and will have implications far beyond the current feeding frenzy in the media. Trump and his team, Obama and his team, the Clintons and their teams will all fall under the spotlight of scrutiny. All of these teams had the means, motive, and opportunity to interfere in the 2016 elections. That is, assuming there was any interference at all. Not to mention all those representatives in Congress who have recent photos of themselves taken with individuals of the Russian government in the recent past. They, too, will be investigated. Never before has an inquiry from a special counsel or independent counsel had such far-reaching consequences for so many current and former presidential administrations and so many members of Congress. It is this fact that will drive many politicians to ramp up their rhetoric to the threshold of reckless comments and actions, many to the point of literally blowing their cover and exposing that many in Congress, regardless of party affiliation, are indistinguishable from one another. I have always said, follow the truth wherever it leads you and act accordingly. This investigation is going to make a whole lot of people in Washington uncomfortable during its course. We may very well see more than a coincidental few resign from Congress or choose not to run again. So far, all we know for certain is that the only people who interfered with the election results, that is, results anticipated by pollsters and those in the media, were the silent majority of individuals who were ignored by pollsters and the media and actually went out and voted. There are four stages of change: denial, resistance, exploration, and acceptance. Many are stuck in the first two stages on this subject: denial and resistance. This investigation will drag many, kicking and screaming without recourse, into the exploration stage of change. And then maybe, just maybe, we can move into the acceptance stage and move on to more pressing matters, like the ticking global debt bomb and the inevitable financial reset. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.